In the southern springtime, on the shores of one of the great lakes that lie in the hot depths of the Rift Valley, that mighty geological fault that splits the shield of the African continent like the stroke of an axe, there occurred at that time a bizarre hatching. The egg masses of Schistocerca gregaria, the desert locust, that were buried in the loose earth along the edge of the lake, released their flightless nymphs. The eggs had been laid in unusually propitious conditions of weather and environment. The swarms of breeding insects had been concentrated by unseasonable winds upon the papyrus banks of the lake, a vast food supply that heightened their fecundity. When the time came for them to spawn, another chance wind pushed them en masse onto a dry, friable terrain of the correct acidity to protect the egg masses from fungus infection, while the mild humidity drifting up from the lake ensured perfectly elastic egg casings from which the hatching of nymphs were able to escape readily. In other less fortuitous seasons, the loss and wastage might be as high as 99%, but this year the kindly earth rendered up such a multitude of nymphs that it could not contain them. Though the hatching ground was almost 50 square miles, the insects were forced to crawl upon each other's backs in layers and drifts and banks 10 and 20 deep, so that the surface of the desert seemed to become a single seething organism, monstrous and terrifying. The constant agitation and stimulation of contact with their siblings wrought a miraculous change in this teeming tide of nymphs. Their colour turned from the drab desert brown of their kind to a vivid orange and metallic midnight black. Their metabolic rate surged, and they became hyperactive and nervous. Their hind legs grew longer and more powerful. Their wings developed with startling rapidity, and they entered the gregarious phase. When they had molted for the last time, and their newly fledged wings had dried, the last chance fluke of weather occurred. The tropical clouds along the valley escarpment blew away, and a terrible sun beat down upon the crawling mass of insects. The valley became an oven, and the entire swarm of mature locusts took spontaneously to the air. In that baptism to flight, the heat that their bodies had sucked up from the baking earth of the valley was increased even further by their muscular activity. They could not stop, and they winged southwards in a cloud that eclipsed the sun and stretched from horizon to horizon. In the cool of the evening, this mighty cloud sank to earth, and the trees of the forest could not bear their weight. Branches as thick as a man's waist snapped off under the clinging masses of insects. In the morning, the rising heat spurred them into flight once more, and they rose to darken the heavens and left the forest stripped bare of its tender spring foliage, so that the empty, twisted branches looked like the limbs of cripples in a strange, dead landscape. Southwards the endless flights poured across the sky, until far below them the silver ribbon of water that was the Zambezi River glinted dully in the shadow of their passing. The whitewashed walls of Kami Mission Station burned in the noon sunlight with the eye-aching brilliance of bleached bone. The family dwelling, surrounded by wide shaded verandas and roofed with thick dark thatch, stood a little apart from the church and its attendant buildings, but all of them seemed to crouch below the line of wooded hills, the way that chickens huddle below the hen when there is a hawk in the sky. From the front steps of the house, the garden stretched down past the well to the little stream. At first, nearer the house, there were roses and bougainvillea, poinsettia and banks of phlox, that formed bright, bold slashes of colour against a felt still brown from the long, dry winter just past. But nearer the stream, the fields of maize were tended by convalescents from the mission clinic, and soon on the tall green plants the immature cobs would begin to eat. Between the rows of corn, the earth was hidden beneath the dark green umbrella leaves of new pumpkin plants. These fields fed the hundreds of hungry mouths, the family and servants and sick, and converts who came from all over Matabele land to this tiny oasis of hope and succour. On the veranda of the main house, at a bare, hand-planed table of heavy makwa wood, the family was seated at the midday meal. It was a meal of steaming salted maize bread baked in the leaves and washed down with maas, the cool, thick, soured milk from a stone jug. And in the opinion of the twins, the grace that preceded it was disproportionately long for such frugal fare. Vicky fidgeted, and Elizabeth sighed at a volume that was carefully calculated not to exceed the knife edge, beyond which it would attract her mother's wrath. Dr. Robin St. John, the doyen of Carmi Mission, had dutifully thanked the Almighty for his bounty, but was going on in conversational tones to point out to him that a little rain soon would help pollination of the immature cobs in the field and ensure a continuation of that bounty. Robin's eyes were closed, and her features were relaxed and serene. Her skin was almost as unlined as that of Victoria's. Her dark hair had the same russet highlights as Elizabeth's, but there was just a fine silver mist at her temples to betray her age. "Dear Lord," she said, "in your wisdom you have allowed our best cow, Buttercup, to lose her milk. We submit to your will, which surpasses all understanding, but we do need milk if this little mission is going to continue to work to your glory." Robin paused to let that sink in. "Amen," said Juba from the far end of the table. Since her conversion to Christianity, Juba had taken to covering her huge black melon-sized breasts with a high-buttoned man's undervest, and amongst the necklaces of ostrich shell and bright ceramic trade beads around her neck hung a simple crucifix of rolled gold on a fine chain. Apart from that, she was still dressed in the traditional costume of a high-ranking Matabele matron. Robin opened her eyes and smiled at her. They were companions of many years, since Robin had rescued her from the hold of the Arab slaving dhow in the Mozambique Channel long before the birth of any of the children, when both of them had been young and unmarried. But it had only been shortly before his destruction by the company forces that King Lobengula had at last given his permission for Juba's conversion to the Christian faith. Juba, the little dove. How she had changed since those far-off days. Now she was the senior wife of Gundang, one of the great Indunas of the Matabele nation, brother of King Lobengula himself, and she had borne him 12 sons, the eldest of whom was Butso, the axe, himself an Induna. 4 of her young sons had died in front of the Maxim machine guns at the Shangani River and the Bembezi crossing. Nevertheless, as soon as that brief, cruel little war had ended, Juba had returned to Carmi Mission and to Robin. Now she smiled back at Robin. Her face was a glossy full moon, the silky black skin stretched tightly over the layers of fat. Her dark eyes sparkled with a lively intelligence, and her teeth were a perfect and unblemished white. On her vast lap, within the circle of her arms, each as thick as a man's thigh, she held Robin St. John's only son. Robert was not quite 2 years old, a thin child without his father's rugged bone structure, but with the same strange yellow-flecked eyes. His skin was sallow from regular doses of anti-malarial quinine. Like many infants born of a mother on the verge of menopause, there was a quaint old-fashioned solemnity about him, like a little old gnome who had already lived 100 years. He watched his mother's face, as though he had understood each word she uttered. Robin closed her eyes again, and the twins, who had perked up at the prospect of a final amen, glanced at each other and slumped with resignation. "Dear Lord, thou knowest of the great experiment upon which thy humble servant will embark before this day ends, and we are certain of your understanding and protection during the dangerous days ahead." Juba's understanding of the English language was just sufficient to follow this injunction, and the smile faded from her face. Even the twins looked up again, both of them so troubled and unhappy that when Robin sounded the long-awaited amen, neither of them reached for the platters or jugs. "Victoria, Elizabeth, you may begin," Robin had to prompt them, and they chewed dismally for a while. "You never told us it was to be today," Vicky spoke up at last. "The young girl from Zama's kraal is a perfect subject. She started her chills an hour ago. I expect her fever to peak before sundown." "Please, Mama," Elizabeth jumped up from her seat and knelt beside Robin with both arms around her waist, her expression stricken. "Please don't do it." "Now don't be a silly girl, Elizabeth," Robin told her firmly, Return to your seat and eat your food. Lizzie's right. Vicky had tears in her green eyes. We don't want you to do this. It's so dangerous, so horrible. Robin's expression softened a little, and she placed one narrow but strong brown hand on Elizabeth's head. Sometimes we have to do things that frighten us. It's God's test of our strength and faith. Robin stroked the lustrous dark hair back from Elizabeth's forehead. Your grandfather, Fuller Ballantyne. Grandfather was touched, Vicky cut in quickly. He was crazy mad. Robin shook her head. Fuller Ballantyne was a great man of God. There were no limits to his vision and courage. It is only the mean little people who call such men mad. They doubted him, as they now doubt me. But as he did, I shall prove the truth, she said firmly. The previous year, Robin had, in her professional capacity as medical superintendent of Carmi Mission, submitted a paper to the British Medical Association in which she set out the conclusions of 20 years' study of tropical malarial fever. At the beginning of the paper, she had scrupulously acknowledged the work of Charles-Louis-Alphonse Laveran, who was the first to isolate the malarial parasite under microscopic examination. But then Robin had gone on to postulate that the periodic paroxysms of chill and fever that characterized the disease were coincident with the segmentation of these parasites in the patient's bloodstream. The august members of the British Medical Association were well aware of Robin's reputation as a political trouble stirrer, a radical who flew in the face of their conservative convictions. They had never forgiven nor forgotten that she had impersonated a man to attend medical school and had desecrated their exclusive masculine preserve by obtaining her medical qualification under false colours. They recalled with pain the furore and scandal that she had conjured up when the governors of St Matthew's Hospital, London, where she had received her training, had attempted, quite reasonably, to revoke her doctorate. Sourly they had looked on as she published a series of highly successful books, culminating in the infamous Trooper Hackett of Matabeleland, a vicious attack on the company in which a great deal of the association's funds were invested. Naturally, the honourable members of such an august body were above such mundane emotions as envy and malice, so none of them had grudged her the princely royalties from her publications, and when some of Robin's outrageous theories on tropical diseases had finally been proven accurate, and after they had been brought under pressure by Oliver Wicks, who was Robin's champion and editor of the Standard, they had magnanimously retracted their previous refutations. Nevertheless, when Dr. Robin St. John, previously Codrington, nee Ballantyne, finally succeeded in hoisting and hanging herself on her own audacity and presumption, the members of the British Medical Association would not be numbered amongst the company of her mourners.